1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 326, Christian Sexual Ethics and Same-Sex Marriage, What We Can Learn from Each Other, by Thomas J. Matthews.
Okay, I think it's about time to begin, so we'll go ahead and get started. I'm Guy Berryessa, so I'm happy to be able to chair this session today. I am excited about the topic and the presenter. I think this is, it's been a wonderful opportunity the last couple years to see the first out-of-the-closet BYU professor emerge and kind of watch that process. I think it's, I have a lot of respect for Dr. Matthews and what he's been doing. I think it's really great. And this topic, I think, is of particular interest to many people in the country right now, certainly myself, and I'm very excited to hear the comments in the presentation today. Dr. Matthews, as I mentioned, was the first out-of-the-closet professor at BYU. He's been an assistant professor of Spanish, and he earned his PhD in linguistics at the University of Delaware, and will be leaving soon, I think beginning within the next few weeks, at Weber State University. So he's currently Nelvish Quorum instructor in his ward in Orem, and we're very happy to have him here. He'll be presenting, and then afterwards there will be time for questions and answers. Thanks. Turn the time over to Tom.
Try to clip it on. Can you hear me? Okay. I'm a teacher with a cold, so you'll have to. I can talk loud, but it probably won't sound very good. For the last 5 years, I've been an assistant professor of Spanish at BYU. My last two classes handed in their final exams on Wednesday, and yesterday I turned in my keys and my parking sticker. Beginning next month, I will be teaching at Weber State University in Ogden. Weber State is my alma mater, and I'm looking forward to being there. For the last year and a half, as Guy has said, I've been publicly out of the closet at BYU, a condition which, as President Rex Lee admitted to the press last October, has been uncomfortable for the university. My status as a celibate gay professor at BYU has caused a considerable amount of comment. Among other things, I have been accused of being a militant radical homosexual. I'd like to talk for a moment about my radicalness, particularly in terms of the subject of this paper, which is same-sex marriage. Also, I'm going to approach this paper not from the more traditional, I think, approach of the rights of marriage and why all people in the United States are or should be entitled to those rights, but rather from the ethics of marriage and the ethics of sexuality and how that relates to same-sex marriage and opposite-sex marriage. My understanding of the term radical is that it refers to someone whose goals include an extreme fundamental change in the way things are done. A radical wishes to dismantle, deconstruct, or even destroy society's institutions and rebuild them with new institutions that will be more in keeping with the principles of his or her radical agenda. By that definition, I am not a radical homosexual. My purpose in this paper is to claim my right to be included in one of society's most basic and fundamental institutions. As a gay man who argues in favor of expanding the legal protections of marriage so that I could be included, I cannot be called a radical. An activist, maybe, but not a radical. I might also add that for me, all of this discussion is strictly hypothetical. Although I often get misty-eyed at the thought of sharing my life intimately with another person, it's not an immediate possibility. I have, as they say, no fish on the line, and no one has ever asked me to marry him. I will start this paper by talking about why people have sex, or why they don't, and then why they get married. While listening to talks at General Conference, watching lots of popular television, and doing my share of reading, I've discovered three reasons as to why I think people have sex. These reasons are, first, procreation, second, recreation, and third, to create intimacy. Perhaps a healthy view of sexuality would involve all three of these possible products of sex: children, fun, and love. But for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to break them up and discuss each of them separately. When I was a missionary, the official missionary discussions taught that the reason why men have such a strong sexual urge is to convince them to marry and raise children. Strong desires and appetites accompany the procreative power because, quote, there is a need to persuade men to accept the responsibility of home and family, end quote. This is a silly argument that says the reason for sex, and the only reason for sex, is to have children. But the reason we like to have sex, particularly the reason men like to have sex, is to persuade them to get married and have children. I am not convinced. I have never wanted to engage in any behavior that could make me a father. And yet I have always wanted to have children. At times I ache to be a father. My sister and her husband have two adorable little daughters. They probably think me frightfully unfriendly or uncaring because I seldom visit, and when I do, I don't stay long. But the truth is that it simply hurts me to see them and to realize what is so missing in my life. So in my case, at least, it seems the Lord got things a bit mixed up and gave me the desire to have a family without the corresponding heterosexual sex drive. Anyway, one argument put forth by the LDS Church and others is that sex exists so that we can have children, and the sex drive exists because otherwise sane people would never want to have children. Another take on the sex as procreation argument, a more cautious one and a more common one, is that marriage exists primarily so that we can have sex. For 3 years, I was the ward clerk in a BYU student ward. I had the opportunity to attend all of the bishop's disciplinary councils. These occurred with some regularity. And the purpose for these disciplinary councils usually concerned some sort of sexual indiscretion on the part of an unmarried BYU student. Whether a man or a woman was before us, the bishop, or one of his counselors, would always ask whether or not there was any possibility of marriage between the sinners. If the answer was yes, then the counsel was to get married and make an end of it. Sexual intercourse, and many of the pastimes leading up to it, is the only activity I can think of which constitutes a major sin, yet for which repentance does not entail forsaking the activity, but merely making the activity legal. One day, you are in danger of losing your membership in the church. The next, after a short meeting with a justice of the peace or a blessing by the bishop, you are faithfully discharging your espousal duty. Elder Boyd K. Packer, in his Little Factory speech, stressed that sex is a sacred procreative power to be used only within the bond of marriage. Quote, young Latter-day Saint men, he counseled, do not tamper with these powers, neither with yourself alone, nor with one of your own kind. It's interesting to note that in this conference talk, Elder Packer never used the word sex. I wonder if any of the younger boys in the Aaronic priesthood were at all confused as to what he was talking about. 2 years later at BYU, Elder Packer gave a devotional speech specifically about homosexuality, in which he made a point of using the word homosexual only once. The church's official policy on homosexuality is that there is a, quote, distinction between immoral thoughts and feelings and participating in either immoral heterosexual or any homosexual behavior, end quote. The duality of the nature of heterosexual behavior is obvious. Some is moral and some is immoral, but any homosexual behavior is immoral. So the basic theology seems to be that sex is for procreation only. Sex for any other reason is sinful. Procreating outside of marriage is sinful. Last year, Elder James E. Faust repeated a common, absurd twist to the discussion, writing about the, quote, inappropriate use of sacred creative powers, end quote, and of homosexuality specifically. He claimed that, quote, if practiced by all adults, these lifestyles would mean the end of the human family, end quote. Elder Faust seems to see homosexual sex as such a temptation that all men might engage in it to the exclusion of heterosexual activity, if not for his preaching against it. The idea that sex is above all a way to have children and should only be engaged in with procreative intent is well established in Christian tradition. Likewise, the idea that marriage exists primarily as the only healthy institution in which people can rear children, thus limiting legitimate sexual activity to marriage, is well established in our Western culture. Justin Martyr wrote in the 2nd century, quote, we Christians do not enter marriage for any other reason than to have children, end quote. Sex, to a Christian, becomes a nasty but necessary means to an end, and is excusable only when the participants are married and when the goal is procreation. St. Augustine came up with the hypothesis of a passionless procreation, wherein love was shared in the Garden of Eden without the lecherous promptings of lust, and conception could have taken place without intercourse. Sadly, after the fall, sex has remained the only approved way to get pregnant. Following this reasoning, any non-procreative use of sex must have as its goal pure venereal pleasure and is therefore sinful and selfish. Homosexual behavior, because it denies even the possibility of children, is completely selfish. Elder Boyd K. Packer proposed at BYU in 1978 that, quote, the cause of homosexuality, when found, will turn out to be a very typical form of selfishness. I do not think for a minute that the form of selfishness at the root of the perversion is a conscious one, but it can become embedded so deeply and disguised so artfully as to be almost indistinguishable. Consider this, continues Elder Packer, one cannot procreate alone, and this, one cannot procreate with his own gender. These are absolutes, and there is a third, one cannot procreate without yielding or giving, end quote. It seems to me that the Mormon ethic of sex as procreation is a bit immature. It is not explanatory. It is indeed confusing. We are taught that the drive to have sex exists to convince us to marry and have children. Yet at the same time, President Benson and others have consistently found it necessary to remind men to get married. And Elder Faust feels it necessary to remind men to have sex with women. The heterosexual sex drive must not be a very strong one. I, of course, cannot speak from experience, but it seems that to some of our church leaders, the very knowledge of the existence of gay sex is such a temptation that it will convince otherwise straight people to go gay. The fear is that if same-sex marriage is allowed, everyone will want to do it. California Assemblyman William Knight said less than a month ago, quote, I don't think it's in the best interests of our children to teach them that homosexuality is an acceptable alternative lifestyle on the same plane with heterosexual marriage. That puts marriage in the category of self-gratification instead of the category of procreation of children. End quote. This common argument against homosexual behavior is that it is sterile and unnatural because it cannot result in procreation. If we buy the argument that the purpose of sex is procreation, then all sexual activity should be limited to behaviors that can or might result in conception. The sex as procreation argument is widespread. It is often used as a threat. Elder Packer put it, quote, this power is ordained for the beginning of life. If you misuse it, you will be sorry, end quote. But it is a weak argument and an overstated threat. The fact that there is and always has been so much sexual activity outside of marriage and so much use of birth control inside marriage leads me to believe that the sex as procreation theology is not a very useful one. Sex and recreation. Popular culture, television, and advertising often represent sex as a purely recreational activity. From Aldous Huxley's Brave New World through the sexual revolution of the 60s, sex, in order for us to view it as entertainment, must be divorced from procreation. In Huxley's dystopia, the very idea of giving birth was culturally unthinkable. The widespread availability and effectiveness of birth control through the last 30 or 40 years has allowed sexual activity to be divorced from from conception and child rearing. The ethic has been repeated often. If it feels good, do it. Any behavior between consenting adults, so long as no one gets hurt, should be okay. For gays and lesbians, the ethic of sex as recreation has been a tempting one. For an unwanted pregnancy is never the accidental outcome of a homosexual union. For gays who have healthy libidos and even strong parenting instincts, but for whom the procreative pieces don't fit, sex as recreation seems to fill the void left by the cruelty of the often repeated ethic of sex as procreation. I believe, however, that a sex as recreation ethic is unacceptable, if only because it cannot be generalized without causing harm. Most sexual unions do run the risk of resulting in conception, and most sexual unions involve the most basic emotional attachments between people. to ignore the affective, emotional aspects of sexuality, and to emphasize this instead only the physical enjoyment of sexual activity, is to invite a slide into hedonism that predictably results in singles bars, bathhouses, prostitution, and other usurious activities that treat sexual partners as mere commodities. The third ethic of sexuality that I like to present deals with sex as an efficient means of creating intimacy. Some have argued that this also is the purpose of marriage. Sex changes everything. A couple that has done it has irrevocably altered the relationship. It is for this reason I believe that those who engage in sex for recreation so often shun relationships. If the sex is taking place with an anonymous partner, then there is no relationship to alter. Every year, the bishop in each of the wards for single students at BYU needs to give a talk on chastity. And as I recently served in a BYU ward, each fall the bishop would give his annual sex talk. And each year I was impressed all over again. Bishop Moon did not try to convince his ward members that sex existed solely for the purpose of creating children. He did not try to frighten them with the prospect of unwanted pregnancy or venereal disease. He did not try to scare them with visions of lonely sex addicts or threaten them with excommunication should they have sex outside of marriage. Rather, he explained to them that the closeness and intimacy created through the sharing of the sexual act is so powerful and so special that it should be reserved for marriage. According to Bishop Moon, this is why the commitment of marriage should come before the intimacy of sexual intercourse. Richard Moore, in his book on gay rights, argues that, quote, marriage is intimacy given substance in the medium of everyday life, end quote. The intimacy of marriage includes, but is by no means limited to sex. Indeed, sexuality is but one tool, perhaps best used within marriage, for creating intimacy. I find it interesting that when people talk, or when the topic of same-sex gender is mentioned, or same-gender marriage is mentioned, a great number of people think immediately and only of sex. Since these people envision sex as a means to have children, and since homosexual couples cannot have children, they assume, wrongly, that the reason for gay marriage is sex as recreation. They do not stop to think of the insult they would feel if their own marriages were defined in purely sexual terms. Indeed, one of the more painful barbs taken at Mormonism by Ed Decker, author of several outrageous anti-Mormon videos and books, is his summation of eternal marriage as eternal sex. Decker claims, quote, Mormons believe that Elohim, the God of Mormonism, and his wives, through endless celestial sex, produced billions of spirit children, end quote. He later wrote that, quote, Mormons will enjoy the eternal pleasure of celestial sex, end quote. As Mormons, we are generally quick to take offense at the reduction of the ennobling doctrine of eternal marriage into one of sexual promiscuity. Marriage and sex in the hereafter will not exist so that we might engender an eternal progeny, nor will they exist so that we might forever enjoy the legal sanction of sexual pleasure. But rather, marriage and sex in the hereafter will have as their primary purpose the same purpose they have here. They will present an unparalleled opportunity to create and maintain intimacy. I have talked about a modern ethic for sexuality. I'd now like to review some thoughts on sexual ethics in the Bible. In Old Testament times, family was defined largely in terms of property rights. The father was the property owner, and as head of the household, was also the owner of his wife and children. The law of Moses put four sanctions on men, on who men could and could not have sex with. 1, no sex with animals. 2, no sex with other men. 3, no sex with a woman who belongs to another man, his wife or his daughters. And 4, no sex with blood relatives, daughters, mothers, etc. For women, the code was somewhat more restrictive. 1, if married, you may sleep only with your husband. 2, if a minor, unemancipated, you may sleep with no one. And 3, if an emancipated woman, you can sleep with anybody, so long as it's not an animal. This is a very different way of describing the sexual world from what we are used to today, but it goes far in explaining some of the seemingly strange wordings in the Old Testament. Men were permitted sexual intimacy with their wife or wives, with other unrelated women in their household, for example, their handmaids, and with unemancipated women, often referred to as harlots. Abraham slept with Hagar, Judah slept with Tamar, his daughter-in-law, and Joshua saved Rahab, the harlot, before destroying Jericho. Sex with a minor, being the property of another man, was forgivable if one was willing to marry the girl. If the act had been a rape, it would still only be punished if the aggressor was unwilling to marry the girl and pay damages to her father. The holiness code in Leviticus makes it very clear that the man, the patriarch, the property owner, is the one who is offended when his property is violated. Leviticus 18, verse 8. The nakedness of thy father's wife shalt thou not uncover. It is thy father's nakedness. Verse 16. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy brother's wife. It is thy brother's nakedness. Verse 10. The nakedness of thy son's daughter or thy daughter's daughter, even their nakedness thou shalt not uncover, for theirs is thine own nakedness. In the Old Testament, adultery was a crime against a man by uncovering the nakedness of his wife, his property. An unmarried woman could not commit adultery. A man, married or single, could only commit adultery with a married woman. Unlike our view of sexuality today, where adulterers are viewed as doing damage to themselves and to one another, the offended party in the Old Testament was the aggrieved husband, certainly not the wife of an adulterous man. The ethics of sexuality in the Bible changed noticeably in the New Testament. Jesus taught that sin was an individual problem and a universal one. Jesus spoke at length about adultery and divorce in order, I believe, to emphasize his change in perspective. We are all sinners by his way of thinking. We are all adulterers. For if we haven't actually done the deed, we have lusted in our hearts. Adultery became less a property offense and more an offense against relationship and a betrayal of love. The New Testament also begins to reserve sex for marriage only. Whereas the Old Testament seems quite forgiving of prostitution and mentions fornication a mere 5 times, all of them metaphorical, the New Testament commonly lists prostitution and fornication with adultery and pride, lying, and blasphemy. The sexual ethic of the New Testament defines sex as a unifier that joins a man and a woman as one flesh. Any sexual activity outside of that joining or premature to it only serves to weaken it. Traditional Christianity has long defined sexual behavior in terms of an ideal. Ideal sex occurs under specific conditions with a specific motive between a certain type of people and in a certain way. The farther the act strays from this ideal, the more sinful and less holy it is. Ideal Mormon sex takes place between a heterosexual couple that has been married in the temple. They approach the sexual encounter with their hearts open to the possibility that pregnancy might result, and they engage in no genital stimulation that could not result in conception. These things are typically called sodomy and are illegal in Utah, even for temple-married Mormons. Masturbation, although certainly a victimless sin, strays very far indeed from the sexual ideal and is therefore traditionally sinful in Christian experience. Homosexual behavior, likewise, threatens the sexual ideal. Hannigan, a Roman Catholic theologian, states this traditional view quite clearly. Quote, "The relationship of marriage between a male and a female is the normative context for human sexual activity, most especially for genital coital activity. Marriage is by its very nature monogamous and indissoluble. Therefore, all deliberately willed and pursued venereal pleasure outside the context of marriage is contrary to nature, against God's will, and consequently sinful. Within marriage, the primary purpose of sexual activity is the procreation of children. Therefore, all forms of contraceptive intercourse, all intercourse during pregnancy or after menopause, and all sexual activity leading to orgasm outside the act of genital intercourse contradict this purpose, are against God's will, as revealed in nature, and so are seriously disordered." Given this basic sexual ethic, All homosexual acts are clearly morally wrong, for they occur outside the context of marriage and cannot be aimed at procreation. End quote. Hannigan's last sentence makes two propositions. First, that homosexual acts are wrong because they take place outside of marriage. And second, that they are wrong because there can be no procreative intent. The first proposition is rather unconvincing. Gays and lesbians are often unmarried because they can't be married. Vituperating someone for not doing something that you won't let him do seems a bit unfair. Nevertheless, Christians have been fairly consistent in their insistence that sex, to be sinless, take place within a legal marriage. The second proposition is even more troubling. If homosexual acts are wrong because even within marriage there can be no possibility of procreation, and if we are willing to ban homosexual marriages for that lack of potential offspring, then our religion and our society should be consistent. All married couples should be open to the possibility, however remote, of conception and parenthood. Certainly, if a couple are old or infertile, through no act of their own, sexual intimacy would be allowed by almost all but Hannigan, who writes that sex with a postmenopausal woman is seriously disordered. Yet just this year, the Utah State Legislature found time to pass a bill making it legal for first cousins to marry in Utah, so long as they are both senior citizens or otherwise demonstrably infertile. This type of marriage is allowed, not with the ever-present hope of procreative intent, but precisely because the couple cannot procreate. To then make same-sex marriages illegal, as the same Utah State Legislature did a year before, on the professed grounds that homosexuals cannot procreate, seems at least a little bit inconsistent. I have tried to show that ethics and mores change over time, and that even synchronically, differing views can be held within the same society or even the same religious tradition. Our culture, American culture in general, and LDS culture in specific, places tremendous value on marriage, and likewise merely tolerates single people. There is certainly no special or esteemed status for single people in the church. A little over a year ago, I was summoned to an interview with Todd Britch, who was at that time vice president and associate provost at BYU. President Britch had been a professor of classics and told me that he had often considered what his life would have been like had he lived in another age and chosen a different path from that of husband and father. His frame of reference was gleaned from medieval history and ran along the lines of the Catholic priesthood and celibacy. It's interesting that his choice did not include living single and celibate in 20th century Utah. Rather, he chose a culture that valued the unmarried state and cherished celibacy. Our LDS culture values only marriage, and unmarried people, whether virgins or widows, divorcees or spinsters, whether celibate or not, are all second-class citizens. This trend, I believe, is general throughout American culture and is merely highlighted and bold-faced among us Mormons. In New Testament times, things seemed a little less clear-cut. The Apostle Paul was tremendously ambivalent about marriage. Chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians seems to apply that marriage is an imperfect but acceptable state for those who can't control their libidos. Yet he wrote a few chapters later that women were created for men, and that a man is incomplete without a woman. In the first epistle to Timothy, he wrote that a bishop should be married, reasoning that if he can't rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Yet he also argued that single men care about the Lord, while he that is married careth for the things that are of the world, and how he may please his wife. I have never read or heard a reasonable LDS explanation of the New Testament reference to the 144,000 single men who will achieve a high status during the millennium. They will be redeemed, the first fruits unto God. They will be without fault. They will sing a new song before the Lord's throne and will have the Father's name written on their foreheads. But most surprisingly, we read in Revelation, they will be virgins. Quote, "These are they which were not defiled with women." End quote. So while in early Christian times both marriage and celibacy were valued, since the Restoration, the Church has consistently placed a premium on the married state. The Church has insisted that members of bishoprics and stake presidents, quote, should be married men of mature judgment, end quote. Today, even a bishop's counselors in a student ward for single members should be mature and married. Single members of the church, and single men in particular, are marginalized. The First Presidency recently proclaimed that, quote, marriage is essential to God's eternal plan, and the family is the fundamental unit of society, end quote. Although the church and our society in general value marriage highly and discriminate against unmarried people, the church is not about to allow all unmarried people to marry just whomever they want to. Until 1978, the church was officially against miscegenation. Back in 1954, Elder Mark E. Peterson addressed a group of religion teachers at BYU and said that, quote, the Negro seeks absorption with the white race. He will not be satisfied until he achieves it by intermarriage, end quote. Through the civil rights movement, the church most certainly changed its stance. Today, good Mormons at least pretend not to be racial bigots. In 1980, just 2 years after the church decided to allow all interracial marriages to occur in the temple, the Ensign printed a pamphlet about the Equal Rights Amendment. Quote, passage of the ERA would carry with it the risks of extending constitutional protection to immoral same-sex, lesbian, and homosexual marriages. The argument of a homosexual male, for example, would be, if a woman can legally marry a man, then equal treatment demands that I be allowed to do the same, end quote. It seems prophetic, since this is precisely the argument being used today to push for legal same-sex marriages in Hawaii under that state's Equal Rights Amendment. Why do people get married? For love and family. What is society's purpose in promoting marriage? The marriage statute in the state of Wisconsin is typical and reads as follows. Marriage is the institution that is the foundation of the family and of society. Its stability is basic to the morality of civilization and of vital interest to society and the state. I have come up with several reasons for state and religious sponsorship of marriage. And the terms I will use to refer to them all cleverly begin with the letter P. They are power, patriarchy, property, procreation, and paternity. This does not paint a necessarily pretty picture of marriage. Certainly, it's not a romantic picture. After this discussion, I will argue why I believe thinking about same-sex marriage for gay and straight people alike actually offers insights for improvement in our conception of the marriage relationship. Power. The state's sponsorship of marriage, and as importantly, the state's reservation of the right to define marriage through licensing, preserves for itself and for the ruling class the power to maintain their own status. Tax benefits, health and educational benefits, employment and property rights that all pass with marriage can be denied to any segment of the population simply by denying them the right to marry or to intermarry. At times, the state or the church feel so comfortable with this position of power, with this self-serving right to decide who can marry and who cannot, that it is taken to extremes. The LDS Church argued last year in the ongoing same-sex marriage case in Hawaii that if same-sex marriages were legal, then Mormon bishops would be required to perform such marriages. On January 23rd of this year, the Hawaiian Supreme Court struck down that argument, pointing out that simply because lawyers, drivers, and dentists are licensed by the state, quote, having such a license does not require them to practice law, drive a vehicle, or practice dentistry, end quote. The church made a silly argument, one that was handled by the court in a footnote to its decision, and the church was responding to a very real threat to its power. Several state legislatures and now the U.S. Congress have responded in similar ways. Patriarchy. State-sponsored marriage promotes patriarchy. Although some changes have been made in the last decade, marriage focuses power and allows for the accumulation of wealth into the hands of men. The traditional Mormon concept is often that the husband is the senior companion, while the wife is the junior companion, or helpmeet. Until fairly recently, divorced women had a difficult time owning property or obtaining credit in their own names. Male-female marriage is all too often a heterosexist institution. It is generally not a great promoter of equality. Property. Marriage laws benefit society by allowing for an orderly distribution of property as the result of death or divorce. Although we hear of a great number of wrenching stories about the difficulties couples endure after the breakup of a marriage, the difficulties are minimal compared to what would occur if there were no laws to guide us in terms of community property, spousal rights, and inheritance. Since most members of our society do indeed marry, these laws serve as a form of standard contract. Many of the provisions of this standard contract cannot be obtained in any other way. Procreation and paternity. Society's interests are served through marriage laws by requiring the rearing of children within a unit, namely the family, that can be held responsible for the children's upbringing and for their possible wrongdoing. It is often said that the family is the basic unit of society. Indeed, having parents rear their own children and making them legally obligated to do so is very efficient. This does not mean that society should insist that all marriages have children, or that all children be reared by their parents, no matter what the situation. Marriage serves society by requiring parents, in most cases, to provide for the financial needs of their children. This, in general, takes a great burden off the state. What does same-sex marriage have to offer? There certainly is a vocal portion of the homosexual political community that feels that marriage is not a right that gays and lesbians should be seeking. Not now, not ever. Paula Edelbrick and Ravashi Vaid argue that marriage is an oppressive institution no matter who participates in it. Nevertheless, the overwhelming feeling today is that most gays and lesbians feel marriage is an important right. I believe that gay relationships can be made better by using the civilizing example of the marriage institution, and that opposite-sex marriages can be made better by considering some of the peculiarities of homogamy. Traditional marriage places an extreme value on covenant, fidelity, and the value of exclusionary intimacy. This is a lesson that is hard to learn even for many married straight people. Yet they have the support of their society, their churches, and their cultural tradition pushing them toward faithful monogamy. Young people in our wards and branches are sent two related messages. First, find someone to be with, date, dance, be social. We have church sports and outings, dances and activities, all with the express purpose of getting the youth together. Thank you. All with the express purpose of getting the youth together so they can meet each other and fall in love. Second, and at the same time, we look carefully over their shoulders and tell them, don't have sex, not until you're married. In the church, singles, young and old, get a lot of support for meeting the opposite sex and equal support for not getting intimate. Gay people have no such support in our society. Gay people need marriage so that they too, as Eskridge terms it, can become civilized. Most of the places where gays and lesbians can meet each other, or can meet other gays and lesbians, have only one message, and it's a message of sex. Sex now, sex cheap, sex for entertainment. And although the gay bars in Salt Lake City are much like the straight singles bars in Salt Lake City, they are not church socials. If long-term, lasting relationships are best built by falling in love first and consummating that love only later, then it is no wonder that so few lasting gay relationships are begun at bars and sex clubs. Gay sex is not about procreation. Remember Elder Packer's absolute. One cannot procreate with his own gender. Reasons for refraining or controlling sexual behavior must be more convincing than the simple fear of pregnancy. My thesis is that marriage is not about procreation either. Gays and lesbians need marriage for the same reasons other people do. Same-sex marriage requires that power be shared. Any giving or taking of power or control must be done voluntarily. There are no cultural norms which define who is the senior and who is the junior companion. In same-sex marriages, there are no predetermined roles. If one partner prefers to cook while the other does the dishes, if one works in an office while the other stays home and keeps the house, if one makes all the economic decisions and the other all the domestic ones, it is because they have mutually decided to make it that way. There is no automatic tiebreaker in case of a difficult problem. No partner can best the other by claiming, I have the priesthood and you don't. I believe that straight couples could learn a lot by watching gay and lesbian couples work through their problems. I have talked about sexual ethics and how they might relate to same-sex marriage. Certainly, most modern people will view the Old Testament property ethic as unacceptable as a guideline for sexual action or for married life. Of the more modern ethics, I have tried to point out that sex is not just about procreation, and that marriage is not just about sex. Also, sex for its own sake comes down to no ethic at all. I conclude that marriage and sex both serve the same end. They can both lead to a rewarding intimacy between two people. I have sometimes wondered why God, when He created us the way He did, why He made sex so important, so unavoidable. It could be that our God is an adolescent and that He has a fixation. I think it more likely that He created sex in us so that we can better love one another. If the only purpose for sex were reproduction, certainly He could have found a less confusing, less messy, less passionate way to do it. But the passion and the complication bring people together, and that has nothing to do with procreation. Once marriage and procreation have been separated, as they are with old cousins in the state of Utah, there is really no reason to deny the social and legal benefits of marriage to same-sex couples. I believe that once this is done, straight and gay marrieds will see that they have much more in common than they do in difference. They will learn that the banality of the day-to-day is where real marriage is found. I'll close by reading a paragraph by Richard Moore. Marriage requires the presence and blending of both necessity and intimacy. Life's necessities are a mixed fortune. On the one hand, they frequently are drag and dross and cussedness. Yet on the other hand, they can constitute opportunity, abidingness, and a prospect for nurture. They are the field across which, the medium through which, and the ground from which the intimacies... I guess I'm supposed to answer... supposed to answer questions if there are any.
Do you have, in preparing your sexual ethics, have you considered the need for sex before marriage, either for gay or straight people, or does your ethic assume the Mormon version that no one should have sex until marriage?
I thought about that a lot. Yeah, his question was whether, in my thinking about sexual ethics, I considered the need for sexual activity or intimacy before marriage.
To be applied.
Yeah. As opposed to the Mormon ethic, and I think the standard Christian ethic is that sexual relations should be reserved for marriage only. As I read the Old Testament, certainly there was nothing wrong about with men, males, having sex before marriage, or with women having sex before or outside of marriage, so long as they were emancipated from their father's household. The New Testament, I think, starts getting fuzzy on the issue, but isn't very clear about it. The New Testament mentions fornication a lot. I'm not quite sure how it's defined. It doesn't ever get defined in the New Testament. It's obviously different from adultery. I think the ethic I end up with, however, is that marriage is about intimacy and sex is an almost immediate way of gaining intimacy and almost too powerful if used without the commitment that accompanies marriage. Whether that means you have to have a license and be married by the state, I don't know, but I really do believe that love, that commitment and relationship should precede the intimacy of sexual activity. Whether that's simply been learned by most cultures, and certainly not all, through the eons of time, that people are better off, families work better, relationships last longer, if we kind of put the brakes on youth and say, just wait, trust us, wait, hold off on this until you can get married. In our culture, we send a competing thing, which is don't get married too soon. So you wait until you're 25 or 30. Wait until you've graduated and got a job and everything's going to go. So, yeah. I don't know if that answers your question. Yeah, I thought about it. Sir?
You studied at Cambridge University a while ago on some figures you gained from the media about the marriage. And told the marriage registration act was practice of preparing the small dose of lead in 20 or 50. The normal practice that we need to do is not in this great sense until after marriage. But the couple of normal practice, the couple of pounds, the couple of engagement, and then after the bride, marriage and church. And this is carried on even in the 20th century. The point being made at Cambridge University,
I have no problem with that. I think that in our society, in the United States at least, there are a great number of political rights, legal rights, that come with state-sponsored marriage. And otherwise, I don't care if people are married, if they decide to live together forever and not get married. That's their business. In our society, you can't get the legal property and rights of attorney and visitation and health benefit rights unless you actually get married. So that saying that a segment of the population can't get married is excluding them from those rights. Right? By saying that I think people should be able to get married, that's not necessarily saying people all have to get married.
Thank you. Offered us a very thoughtful review of the predicament that we now find ourselves in. My question, unfortunately, is not directly relevant to your remarks, but it is a sincere question. What are you going to do when a tape of your address gets into the hands of President Nixon?
The question is, what will I do when a tape of my remarks gets into the hand of President Bateman? I'm hoping that I have done a better job than he appears to have done in one of his recent addresses at citing references. I don't work for President Bateman anymore. I turned in my keys yesterday. I hope they'll give me my last paycheck at the end of the month. But, I did receive a call from one of the First Quorum of 70 a couple of weeks ago who saw my name in the program and asked me to send him a copy of the paper whenever I get it done. But he used to be my state president and is a fine man. And my impression was he said he'd also like to get here and talk to me. He's genuinely interested in the issue and trying to work things out, so... I didn't get the impression that it was going to be something they could take and pick apart and send a copy to my bishop. Yes? The question is, how would I respond to people who use simply theological, ecclesiastical, or scriptural arguments, I guess, for limiting marriage to opposite sex? I find those arguments really interesting when they're coming from Mormons. And that's not an original thought on my part. The LDS Church has a history of treating marriage in a way that our culture doesn't treat it. I have two great-great-grandfathers who each had three wives. And I'm descended from the first wife in both cases, so there's no problem. But these people defined marriage in a different way from their culture, or from the culture at large, and were offended when Easterners saw the whole issue of polygamy as a sexual one. That they couldn't see Joseph Smith as anybody but a whoremonger. Whereas LDS people typically looked at this as a law of God and did not see these relationships any more sexualized than most of you in this audience see your marriages or relationships as purely sexual ones. I think it's a faulty argument. In one place in my talk, I mentioned that marriage and sexuality aid in the intimacy of two people, and I really wondered about putting the word two in it. It sounded a lot better when I said it that way. But obviously, I really don't believe the state should necessarily be telling people who they should marry or how many people they should marry. There have to be limits as to marrying young children who don't have any say in the matter. Yeah, the question is whether Mormons have to go through a more imaginative leap to envision eternal same-sex marriage or church-sponsored same-sex marriage than people who are not members of the church, who are no longer members of the church. And as an active member of the church, yes, I find that troubling. I find the temple ceremony and the plan of salvation not very explanatory for me. I use that word in a technical way. I'm a linguist, and Noam Chomsky, probably the greatest linguist of this century in this country, has come up with three tiers for theories. And the first one is that a theory can be merely observationally adequate. You merely say what you observe, and that's all you do. The next level is that it describes how things work. And the third level is it explains why things work the way they do. Genesis is a good example. The theory of evolution is trying to be observationally adequate. It's trying to tell us how man came to be. The book of Genesis, the book of Moses, the temple endowment, try to tell us why man came to be, and at that level try to be explanatory. Well, for me, in my case, they're not very explanatory as far as the eternities go, because I don't know where I fit in there. I don't know how sex will work in the hereafter. I find it interesting that throughout the scriptures we read that God created man in his own image, male and female. And that's always struck me as a little bit strange. I don't know how gods reproduce. Maybe it is a lack of imagination to assume that gods have to reproduce the same way we, the creature, do. Certainly not the topic of my talk, and I haven't thought it through. I don't have the answers. That's for the church to give me those answers. I haven't done it. And then, It kind of happened the other way around. That is, I made a decision several years ago to leave BYU. I waited until now because last year, not this last academic year, but the year before, I passed my first step on the way to tenure and figured that looking for a job during this last year would be easier having that good mark behind me. So this was a good year to look for a job. And so it was during that former year that I realized I was going to be leaving. And started just talking to people. If they asked me why I wasn't married, or they... students at BYU are often surprised that there are even single professors there. They didn't know you could get hired if you weren't married. And I would simply start telling colleagues and students, well, the reason I'm not married is because I'm gay. And if they wanted to know more, I'd tell them more. And if they didn't, I wouldn't. Some student told an apostle. I don't know who it was. I don't know who the student was. I don't know which apostle it was either. And it went from there. But... My first meeting with university authorities kind of put them at ease, because I am planning on leaving, was my response. And so I was never asked to leave. I'm sure they wouldn't have let me stay eternally. But you're right. The reason I'm leaving is because I need more possibilities. I don't know if I want to be a monk.
And could you also, have you considered
you already determined in your mind what you're going to do? Should you fall in love? Are you willing to forsake your church membership?
I'm hoping it doesn't come down to that. And my experience as an active member of the church, watching a bishopric closely as a clerk, participating as one of the counselors when one of them was missing in disciplinary councils, I really think you almost have to call attention. Now, maybe I'm doing that, calling attention to myself. But most bishops, and there's a great deal of variation, which I think is too bad, but I don't think most bishops are out looking for people to excommunicate. And so long as I don't go in and insist on being elders quorum president and, they'll leave me alone. I think that's a common experience. So I'm hoping it doesn't come to giving one up for the other. But, I think if I were to fall in love, that I would risk a lot for that. So. There was a question up here. Excuse me.
Say you're talking about the imagination. Well, in Western Washington, a lot of the young couples, gay and lesbian couples, they don't have marriage, but they have families in various ways. And they're out in the suburbs, and there's been a lot of teaching in the paper, and they're sort of becoming part of suburbia and part of the American scene, And I think that part of that changes the perception of the public, and it also helps the gay people, other people who might be thinking of that, some models. And there's some little busted ones that are up there. It's really kind of neat.
Yeah.
They work in the PTA.
Thank you for that. I think that's how most human rights movements work. Certainly when we talk about interracial marriage, back in the 50s and the 60s, when it was illegal in the state of Utah for black people to marry white people, well, there just weren't very many black people to be offended by that. And there weren't very many white people to even realize anything was out of the way. And they hadn't seen it one way or the other. Many of them hadn't even given any thought. Doug Wright on KSL Radio the other day, just last week, was talking about same-sex marriage. And he said, well, I have a lot of friends who are gay. Typical statement of a bigot. I have a lot of Jewish friends. I have a lot of black friends. But he says, it's just in my gut. He says, it's just not right. And I just picture him in Mississippi in the 60s. It just ain't right. And seeing people next door to you or down the street who are normal people is what makes the difference.
I think you also addressed the comment, either or notion, that either you can be a gay celibate Mormon monk, or you can forfeit your membership because you follow up. I mean, in reality, there are so many gay Mormons I know with so many different levels of some are S and some are not. Some are just left.
Yeah, I don't think it's an either or. All of this kind of hit the fan at BYU a year ago, year and a half ago, and I decided to go. I had been in a BYU ward with Bishop Moon, who I mentioned in my talk. He was a colleague of mine, and my office was down the hall from his, so it was convenient for me to be his clerk. And I had been released that spring, so I went to talk to my home ward bishop, and I hadn't attended that ward for about 3 years, and went in and said, I have a situation that has arisen at work. And he went and locked his office door. And I did my little coming out talk. And he said, oh, that's not a problem. He says, my younger brother is gay. And, no problem. 2 weeks later, I was made Elders Quorum instructor. And I think there's a lot of variation out there. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. But I'd rather see the variation than some kind of draconian law from the top come down and not let people be inspired to work the way they want to. Rob?
It wasn't as wrong as yourself. You covered yourself. But if you were, you would quite have a different experience.
I'm sure I would. BYU and Utah is very enamored of virginity. And there's a kind of, gay or not, there's a kind of sweet, immature innocence attached to someone who gets up and says, I'm celibate. And so they'll put up with a lot. If I were not celibate, I would no longer be working at BYU. That's the end of it.
Yeah, I think. Talk a lot about the social ethics
Yeah. The question is that I have talked about social religious ethics, but I haven't really talked about my relationship with God or what I think God feels about sexuality. I think I hinted at the end of my talk the fact that I don't know. I guess as a deficit to my own spirituality, I have not been particularly good at knowing the mind of God. It took me a long time to realize, as far as this whole gay thing went, as far as me becoming, quote, normal, unquote, and living the normal Mormon life, that the answer was no. I think he'd been telling me no since I was 13. It took me till I was 35 to accept the answer. I don't think I'm going to be enlightened on that. But I can't believe that God is so fixated on sex as our culture and as our church is. Unless we really do have an adolescent teenage God who's got too many divine hormones flowing. Sex has to serve some other purpose besides just having babies. And either that, or I could go and be, you know, some kind of biological evolutionist and write God out of the picture. This is just the way it happened to evolve, which was messy. There has to be some other answer, and I'm not sure what it is. I think we're out of time, but one more comment.